Hello everybody, welcome back to a new episode of the Long Jump Podcast, the podcast where we look for interesting people with fascinating stories. And a fascinating story we have today, because we are talking to Danielle Le Tourneau, who is the number 22 ranked female squash player in the world at the moment. It's a fascinating insight into the life of a professional athlete, and we cover many aspects of her life, her move from Canada to Cairo, how she trains, how she approaches matches and tournaments, and how she's aiming to crack the global top 10 of squash in the years to come. We talk a lot about the game, her preparation, the mental side of things, the way squash is going and developing, and of course all aspects of her life as a professional athlete. A fascinating insight, I think, into the life of somebody who has made the step to be completely dedicated to squash. Super interesting, and I hope you enjoy to listen to it. Danielle, all the way from Egypt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
For the people that don't know you, who are you? What do you do?
So, professional squash player from Canada, currently ranked 22 in the world. I went to Cornell University, and then once I graduated, I started playing professionally, lived in Calgary, and moved to Egypt.
And you're 28, if I'm correct?
Yeah, just turned 28.
Just turned 28. How long have you been a professional player?
I guess now, 6 years, almost exactly, yeah.
Because what does it mean to be a professional player? Is it purely just that you can live off your sport?
Yeah, I'd say I would say you're just all in. You're not.
This is what you do.
This is what I do. It's live, sleep, eat, breathe, everything squash, and just kind of put everything aside for it.
Cool. That's quite a commitment. Taking a small step back, you said you grew up in Alberta. I saw in your bio, obviously, that you studied communication and international relations. Mm-hmm. And you it was a YouTube video actually on your channel. You explained that you were hitting plateaus at home. You were winning some stuff, but you weren't really progressing. Is that where you made the decision, okay, it's going to be either squash or what I studied and find a career?
Yeah, a little bit, to be honest. I felt that I still wanted to give it at least another year at the time. But if I stayed in the same ranking area, or if I didn't feel like I was getting any big wins, then it was probably time to, you know, to call it. But yeah. Obviously needed a change to like get that growth. And
because I would imagine that's where a lot of people sort of end. Like, okay, I'm a good player, I'm a good junior, but you know, life is also happening, and you know, it was a good run and that's it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, with COVID, a lot of players have been, you know, you're stuck in a position right now where there might not be tournaments, there's uncertainty. So it's like, okay, what do I do now? Or what's the backup plan? Because, you know, you might realize there's something missing or you don't know what you're going to do once squash is done. Luckily, I think because of school, I've always felt kind of secure in being able to play and like having gone to university. But you know, it does pass your mind if you've had a, you know, a bit of a rough season and nothing's really happening. Like, okay, you know, I've had my goal and, you know, you want to reach it. Mine's always been at least top 10, not higher. And, you know, for a while I was kind of reaching a point where I didn't know if it was actually possible. Now I do. Now I believe in it 100% and I feel like I'm, you know, on track. But for a while it was kind of a big toss up.
So did that realization that you could make the top 10 come after you turned pro or before?
No, I always thought about it before. Like I've been thinking about top 10 since I was probably 11, 12 years old.
Oh.
And I, you know, squash wise, I felt like I was really doing well through juniors. You go to school and kind of, you know, squash took a bit of a back, you know, was in the background a bit more. Like I was still training, but it wasn't my main priority. And then coming to play. Exactly. Yeah. And then when you come play pro, it's a very different style, very different game. Everyone's fighting and you kind of realize pretty soon how much harder that goal actually is.
Yeah. Is that a really big step? Like from like being a good player to becoming an actually good player?
Yeah, I'd say
so. How big a difference is that?
It's funny. So when I first was starting to play pro, I didn't realize how big it was because you're playing, maybe I was coming in and us playing players around 60, 50 and saying, okay, no, I feel like I can compete here. Then you're getting close to these other players. But then once you start getting kind of exposure to the top players, like I practice with Raneem, even just practice, and you see it then. You're like, okay, this is a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
And even like the more you play them, the more you can kind of pick up on what are the differences and try and get there. But until you reach that point, you know, it's hard to acknowledge how much is missing because you don't know.
No, because you think, I mean, if you look at yourself, you're pretty good and I'm winning until you actually reach that, like you say, that occasional top player. And you're like, oh, okay.
It's a wake up call.
Yeah.
And, exactly.
And it's not I always nice found, because I played for, I think for 10 years or something, that if somebody is 5% better than you, especially in squash, it's only possible to win, obviously, but you're such a step behind already. So I can only imagine how that is if somebody's 20% better.
Yeah, and it's even just like, even at that 5% in different areas. So it's not even just all around. It could be, let's say you're doing rotating drives on the back end, which is where a lot of the game is played.
Yeah.
Being that 5% worse in that area makes a huge difference compared to,
yeah.
You know, I could be 100% forehand drop. But how often am I going to get those chances? It won't make a difference.
Yeah. And then because you're always sort of a step and a half behind, you don't get the opportunity to create your own opportunities either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's a cascading effect.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually, I wanted to specifically ask about that because you're now, you know, borderline top 20. Mm-hmm. At that level, everybody is good, obviously. But at that level, everybody trains like crazy. Everybody eats properly. Everybody does all the drills. Everybody is fitter than fit. What makes the difference at that point? Because the margins are small, I get that. But it's what makes the difference between a 19 ranked player and a second ranked player?
You know, I'd say a lot of us are very even. I would say some of it comes down to the experience and learning how to finish off matches, because at that point when you're playing someone around your own ranking, it can go either way.
The form of the day.
And also, exactly, it depends on the day. You know, style matchups, like someone's style could be more awkward. Like let's look at Annie Al before she retired when she was ranked number 10. She had a very unique style, lob drop, and no one really can replicate it.
Yeah.
But she gave so many people so much trouble.
Because of that.
Because it's different.
Yeah.
So I would say like, it's a matter of style, but then also, you know, the experience and learning how to win matches and gain that confidence to win. And
yeah. Is that the, especially when you get to bigger tournaments and you know, more serious matches where there's, you know, money on the line as well and ranking points. Is that sort of the final part of the match, like finishing points off, getting things straight in your head? Is that a big part of the game?
Yeah, I'd say so. And I think going into those tournaments, you don't want to be thinking about those stresses. You don't want to be thinking about the rankings or the money. And that was a mistake I made early on. You go into a tournament and like, okay, especially before when there was qualifying, you could go play first round, make no money. And so that's in the back of your mind, like, okay, I have to win this match to at least get something.
Get something out of it.
Some point. Yeah, get some points, get some money. I think now that there's, you know, your guaranteed prize money, that helps. But, you know, you don't want to be thinking about those things when you're playing.
Not too much, no.
No, it's all about just staying in the moment, I'd say, and just sticking to what you need to do and no matter the occasion. Obviously, it's hard. Like I found when I played pyramids, like I had two really good wins when I was playing Tribini at the pyramids, and it didn't matter how good I played that day, I wasn't going to win that match. But I would say that having the experience to handle that situation, like the grandness of playing in front of the pyramids, squash TV, and it's a bigger deal, and you know, you're trying not to think about it, you're trying to be like, okay, I'm focused on squash, that's what I'm doing. But inside, you know, you're excited, you have those emotions, and learning how to handle those is, I'd say, quite a big step.
I can imagine.
And even getting used to like squash TV, there's cameras, there's the review, knowing how to use the review, remembering to use it, like those are small things, and it takes time.
So that is an experience builder that you need to crack the top 10, then you'd say.
Yeah, I'd say that, and then just, you know, keep working on the game. There's a difference between, I'd say, some of the, you know, the top 10, especially the top 6, I would say is a very different, even to 8 are a very different level. And then everyone else after that is very close. So, you know, to get to that top 5 area, you need to, it's also getting the squash part.
Yeah.
It's that much better.
Is it, with, like you say, with like playing in front of the pyramids, like the occasion itself, when you have to keep telling yourself, focus on squash, execute the game plan. Is that not sort of almost the opposite effect, that you're so focused on focusing and therefore you forget to focus? How do you deal with that?
Yes and no. I mean, in that match, I wouldn't say I was so just trying to focus on the squash, because I was still trying to take in the experience.
Mm-hmm.
That one's separate, because I mean, first time playing her, you don't know where the ball's going. And like, I'm hoping if I get a chance to play her again, that I can, you know, I can play better and I'll be a bit more relaxed and actually have an idea of what to do.
Yeah.
But first time on with her, like, it's, there's nothing that was going to prepare me for that match.
Nice.
Even if I was focusing too hard or not focusing too much, like that one, I was just getting,
yeah,
you know, that one's done.
If you look at, for example, Usain Bolt, like, he sort of embraces the occasion, right? He plays with the mm-hmm. crowd, like the whole show around it is his way of dealing with pressure, right?
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? Is it like, do you, whatever, take a Zen moment for yourself in the locker room, or do you talk to yourself in breaks, or how do you deal with those moments?
I normally try and calm myself down, because I'm generally very hyper and excited, and I can pump myself up very easily.
Yeah.
And I'll get into the event, and but if I get too excited, then I'll be tense.
Yeah,
so for me, it's about not. Yeah. So for me, I have to calm myself down more than pump myself up, because I have too much energy.
Is it, do you approach games with a set game plan?
Generally, yeah. Some matches I won't, but most of the time I'll have, you know, my plan in how I like to play, and then also take into consideration like what someone else does and what their strengths are, how I might try and combat that. But I'd say normally I would go out and play my game first and maybe just tweak it slightly.
Yeah. So do you then sit down and watch like previous matches with that person, or do you have notes from your own matches with that person?
Yeah, mixture.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say I like to watch, definitely like to watch my opponents when they're playing well, when they're not playing well, see patterns, I guess. Because everyone has like some set routines, so at least you can anticipate, especially if it's someone who has,
yeah,
you know, really good hands, has deception. What do they like to do? And then in my own match, I do like to keep notes more. It's less about what they did, it's more about how I reacted and about what I could have done better, not just plan wise, but yeah. And I'll rewatch matches if there's like a recording of it.
Yeah, that's a nice bridge, actually, because the game itself has evolved a lot in, let's say, the past 5 years, even with Squash TV, with YouTube, with social channels, the physical state of the, especially the glass courts, you know, that you see the ball better on TV. So there's been a pretty big jump in that. How has the game itself evolved, like the physical squash playing game, because the players have gotten, you know, bigger, stronger, faster, and the point system has changed a little bit. You mentioned the reviews earlier as well. Like, is the game now at a point where it is matured, or is it still like going forward?
I mean, I think it'll always keep evolving, but I'd say it's definitely moved into a faster pace, more attacking game, especially in the women's. Yeah. You know, with the lower tin, attacking shots have made like a big difference.
Yeah.
So I'd say you'd have to be quite a bit faster to pick those up, and so the physicality comes in when you watch like Hanny, or you watch Kimi, or when Renine was playing. But then you also have to have the attacking game to go with it.
Because there was a comment earlier on, right, that the game was getting too physical and players were actually being sort of forced to hurt themselves during the games because it was, yeah, they're all good. And then the points will just last forever.
Yeah, I can see why, especially if you have to like do the before when there's like the hand in, hand out.
Yeah.
I mean, for like, there still is, but I'm saying with the serve, having to win a point with the serve. And having a strategy for when you're serving, when you're not serving. I do think it's important to keep the physical side. So for me, I personally don't like the best of three. I much prefer the best of five. So at least then it's not all attacking in quick speed. You still have to have the endurance and the ability to keep pushing into later games.
Yeah.
So I think there's a fine balance. I think the best of three is a bit, I think that it takes it away too much.
Could you maybe raise the points, go to 15 or something?
Maybe.
That the game itself is only three, but the game lasts longer?
Maybe. That could work.
Is that a similar concern for the men? Because obviously they're best of five. But generally the games last 10 to 15 minutes, I'd say. Is that a similar concern for them? Or are they physically so fit that it doesn't really matter?
I think it still comes into play with the men's, maybe less so at the top level with the, you know, everyone in the top 10 is going to be very fit or top 20. But
yeah.
I think it still comes in. Like you look at over the course of a whole tournament, maybe the first few rounds, maybe won't come into play, but then you get to a final and you can see someone, you know, as fit as Paul, you know, start to lose some of that extra speed that maybe he had.
Well, as with those longer tournaments, it's obviously key to get the first rounds done as quickly and as efficiently as possible, right? So then you get the whole game of tournament strategy involved as well. Is it fair, the tournament setups?
What do you mean, in what way?
Well, if you look at, for example, tennis, there's if you want to make it to a major, there's like qualifiers and pre-rounds and middle rounds and seeding rounds and who knows what else. So if you want to make it as, let's say, somebody who is in the top 100, but not, you know, in the top 20, you have to play so much before you even get to the, you know, the real level. Obviously they're fit too, but you have so much more match time in your legs and in your arms that I wouldn't say it becomes necessarily easier for the top players to beat you, but, you know, you've gone through that whole road already before you're there. Is it similar with squash?
No, I wouldn't say so, because, I mean, for qualifiers, they only really use that for world champs, where they'll have like a pre-qualifying event and they won't be right before. Like there's going to be one in Denmark. I think it's in a week or 2 weeks. It's something like that. And so that's a pre-qualifier event. So there's still quite a bit of time for those players to recover, but only the winner gets to qualify.
Fair enough.
And same with the wild card. They had a US tournament on right now. But only one of those players goes through. So I would say for the big events, it is hard to get into them. You have to get your ranking up first through all the small tournaments to even have a chance to play them. Whereas I think with tennis, there's more qualifying opportunities to get into the big ones. So you get more mixture of players coming in. Whereas right now, I'd say I go to the tournament, I see kind of the same people.
Which makes sense.
Until you get like a breakthrough player who has had a couple really good events coming through.
Yeah. But then, I suppose it's also fair because in the end, the audience comes to see top level squash, not to be, you know, semi-entertained with some amateur being off the court in 20 minutes.
Yeah. But I mean, that can still happen.
Of course. There's always surprises, right? But in the end, you come to see the top players play the best squash possible, obviously.
Yeah.
You made a YouTube video about sort of a day in the life of Danielle on what you do. Talk me through a day. So you get up in the morning and then what? What's a typical day like?
Okay. So I kind of have two sets of days. So one of the days I'll wake up, have my breakfast, then I'll go to the normally 8:30.
It's not too bad.
Not too bad. It's normally I'll try and push it to 9, but normally 8:30 and then make breakfast. I'll Uber to the club and I'll do a movement ghosting session with Samir. And then after his session, I'll normally solo for maybe an hour. And then I might play a match at night.
Okay.
So that's kind of...
3 sessions a day?
Yeah, that's... Yeah, so 3 sessions a day. And that would be probably 2, maybe 3 times a week, that setup. Mm-hmm. And then other days, I'll have a lesson with my coach, Kareem. Normally around 11. And then I go straight from that to fitness with, I just started working with a new trainer here, Dabo. And so I'll see him at 1 till 2:30, go back, eat, nap, and then play a match at night, or depending, normally I'll take 1 day off matches. So I'll probably play 4 matches a week, not 5.
Okay.
But yeah, normally I'll play a match at night or something like that.
And then the weekends you're off?
Just on Friday.
Okay.
So it's a half day on Thursday, mm-hmm. and then Friday is the weekend, and then things start up again Saturday. So it's a very different, they have different weekends here. So it's Saturday to Thursday.
Yeah. And is this routine sort of comparable to other top players?
I'd say similar. I mean, everyone might have their timing slightly different, but I'd say most players here are doing, 2-3 sessions a day, matches at night.
So is there, how much room is there to get better in that sort of schedule? Because I can imagine at some point adding more volume to it is sort of, doesn't make much of a difference anymore. If you make it 4 sessions a day or 5 sessions a day, it's not like you will increase to get better at the same rate.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on the phase of training. So let's say right now I'm loading up pretty heavy. And my fitness is going to be very heavy because I don't have a tournament for a while. So the squash, my sessions will be intense, but normally I'll reach a certain point when if the quality goes down too much, I'll back off the intense training and then go into more easier, lighter stuff, or listen to my body, listen to how I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. But then I'd say there's other phases where obviously squash is the priority. And so I'd up the quality there and intensity there, focus more on my match play right before a tournament. So maybe my other sessions will kind of be a little bit lighter. So then I can put all my attention into the matches. So it kind of depends on what my focus is at the time.
Yeah. And what your actual match schedule looks like.
Yeah. Cause right now I'm playing matches and, obviously I want to play well and I'm focusing on things I'm working on, but if I don't win, it's not.
No,
so yeah, there's not a whole lot of pressure on it. Sorry?
You're sort of in an off season right now.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. I played in Amsterdam in my time, where the Dutch and British teams trained, and also where Nicole Davis used to train. Mm-hmm. And I always thought it was very fascinating to watch them train and see the drills that they did. And watching a bunch of your training videos, there's so much basic stuff, so much base work, walking the lines, hitting up and down the wall, simple things, constantly repeating that. How much of your training is purely foundation work and how much of it is actual sort of developing new skills?
Well, I'd say it's probably mostly improving what I have, but I have been developing a lot of new skills too.
Example.
I would say I can be doing the same basic drill, but I'm working on a different thing. So like drop drive, I could be working on my swing, or I could be working on my movement, or I could be working on my timing.
Okay.
So the drill doesn't necessarily matter. I still probably have the same targets at the back that I would be normally trying to hit, but with a different focus. So I'm still learning new things, but it's always within that same basic.
Yeah.
Drill.
So the drill stays the same, but the focus of the drill changes.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So then, keep the quality up. It's not just getting, mindless. Okay, I'm doing drop drive. There's always a focus.
Yeah. That makes sense. And you mentioned that there's part of your training is fitness. So you're in the gym. Mm-hmm. Obviously it is the balancing act between being super strong, but also being light on your feet. How do you balance that with each other? As I can imagine, you're not squatting 500 kilos for reps because that just doesn't fit any purpose. But on the other hand, you're probably also not working with 5 kilos. So how do you?
I just trust Dabo and what he does. So, and I think he finds a good balance. We could be doing some heavy lifting, or we can do some endurance stuff, and then he'll add in a speed exercise in between. So you're always doing mini circuits, kind of including a variety of those skills.
Yeah.
I'm not really the expert to say like how I balance it, because I pretty much just show up and I do what he says.
The life of a professional player.
Yeah. And so far it's working. So
nice. A big part of your vlogs is your food of the week.
Oh yeah.
How does your eating regime look like? Because obviously you're not you eat and you train for function, not necessarily how it looks like a bodybuilder, for example. So how does your food schedule look like in a day?
So actually a few months after moving here, I was struggling with kind of adjusting my food. So I started working with a nutritionist, Dr. Haney. Nice. And so he gives me a pretty much like set meal plan per day. And I follow that plan each day, except, you know, if I want a treat, I'll grab a treat. Like if I'm really craving something, it's okay.
Yeah. Does he give you specific foods to eat, or does he give you sort of macro targets to hit?
Specific foods at specific times.
Nice.
So I might like wake up, I'll have eggs and toast. And he'll like specify how many pieces of toast depending on what time of phase of training I'm in. You know, obviously have my recovery stuff like a banana protein after working out. Pretty decent size lunch, which is something I've always been more of a snacker, and I realized I didn't have enough energy beforehand. So make sure I have like a pretty big lunch, another snack, play, recovery stuff, smaller dinner.
Okay. Pretty simple.
Pretty simple, very basic food. I don't normally, it's all very basic, like, you know, chicken, veggies, rice.
Yeah.
The food of steak, pasta.
Nice.
Very basic. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you need lots of fuel if you want to make it through 3 training sessions a day, obviously.
Yeah.
Is there a point in where you are right now, physically and in your game, to get bigger, stronger, faster, or is it more focused on the shots and the technique and those kind of things?
I'd say both. So like with Dabo, I'd say I'm obviously always working on getting faster, fitter, stronger. Like our whole thing is make me into a beast, make me super fit where I can't break.
Yeah.
And then with the squash stuff, I mean, he and my coach are always in contact. And so, you know, it's taking that physicality, but then using it with my squash, using it with my shots, and just getting, you know, the higher pace. Whereas you look at the top players, even if they play with finesse, the pace is still high.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of the physicality is just getting to that level and then making sure my squash skills kind of keep up.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Is it, obviously you're not gaining 10% strength overnight, right? But how much do you have to adjust your game to your improved physicality?
I think it's kind of been coming together fairly easily, to be honest. Because I think my sessions include, like my squash sessions include physicality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everything kind of comes together at the same time.
Yeah, natural progression.
I'd say it's just naturally kind of come together.
That's nice.
I think at first, when I first moved here, it didn't. It did take a little bit of what, like, you know, maybe I was getting to more shots or getting in better position to do stuff, and I was surprised that I was able to do it. Like in positions where I used to always have to lob, it's like, okay, I don't have to lob anymore. I'm there. And it's more, less the squash like skills, it's more mentally just being like, okay,
yeah, I have so much more time.
I can do more.
What do I do?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Nice. That must be pretty cool, actually, that you can feel the progression that way. That you're like, oh, yeah, okay, hello, this is working.
Yeah, it's nice. It's only a little frustrating when sometimes you're like, I'm there and then you're messing up the opportunity, but
but at least you're there.
It's part of it. It's all part of it.
Fair enough. Is it what do you say is your biggest strength in your game?
Sorry, it cut out a little bit.
What would you say is your biggest strength in the game?
I'd say right now my basic game, back of the court, feeling pretty good.
Awesome. And obviously, what's your biggest weakness?
Well, I don't want to say because then everyone else
will be. And everybody knows.
Just attack that person, yeah. I think I still have work to do with my, with my attacking game. It's coming along, it's improved, but I wouldn't say it's where I want it to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you, so your goal, I said earlier, your goal is top 10.
Mm-hmm.
When do you see that happening? I mean, obviously I'm not going to pin you on a date like, April 1st, it has to happen, but you're just outside top 20 now. You're obviously working hard to make that happen. Assuming that after the summer, all the COVID stuff is sort of hopefully gone.
Hopefully gone.
Sort of regular stuff in tournaments and everything can happen again. How do you see the rest of this year and towards that progression to top 10?
I'm confident in it. Obviously, it's tough, but I'd say my goal for that is year and a half.
Okay.
So that's the goal. It might be ambitious, but I'm...
Why not? Goals have to be ambitious. It.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's say end of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Is that... Okay. How realistic is that, you think?
I think very. I'm on the right path, and I trust my team, and I trust what I'm doing, and, I think getting... the match play experience. I had a good match against Amanda at in Alguna, and had my chances, and I think if I can just kind of convert those opportunities and get closer, it'll come.
Yeah. So you're 28, almost just 28, you said. 10 years maximum still in the game?
10 years. Oh, that's a long time. We'll see. It depends where I'm at. I don't have a set, a set timeline. When I graduated, my original timeline was a lot shorter than what it's already been. I was thinking 5 years.
Yeah, but no.
Now it just kind of keeps going. I'm going to say at least probably like 5-6 years, but, at some point, I would like to, move on with life and see what's in store for me afterwards. And
do you ever think about a life after squash?
Yeah, definitely. Lately I've been thinking about it a little bit less, just because I think before I've been looking at what's after squash and having it as a backup plan, partly because I've had more doubts.
Yeah.
And it's been it's always good to plan for what's after, but I don't want it to also be thinking, I don't want my head to be here when I'm trying to be here. So right now I'm just thinking squash because I don't plan on retiring anytime soon. But afterwards, I've thought about a lot of different types of careers that interest me. I think I'm interested in a lot of things. So trying to narrow it down to what suits me is, a bit tough, but I think just meeting people, networking, learning more about what people do, it's kind of helps give me some direction.
Yeah. But could you, for example, see yourself as a coach or...
I think it depends on the setting. I thought about maybe trying to go coach at a university and do the college route, and then also look at getting maybe more education, or eventually finding a job outside of squash. But, to start out, I think it'd be a pretty cool opportunity to work within the college squash as a coach. I had a great experience at Cornell, so
yeah,
I think it'd be pretty cool to give back. Coaching wise, I think I could do it for a little while, but I don't think it's what I want to do long term. I think I'd actually be better suited if I were doing fitness coaching instead of squash coaching. I think it suits me a little bit more. Obviously, I'd need more education within that specific, realm, and be more, certified to actually do it. But I've considered it. I haven't turned the idea down, but I also see myself doing something using my communications, maybe doing marketing. I remember meeting someone who does marketing for the Olympics. And I was like, that sounded like such a cool job, or going down that route where it's still sports related and you still can deal with people with the same interests or who are athlete minded. So I mean, I think I'd like to stay within the realm of sports, but not necessarily coaching.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a fair point that you say, you know, do the squash career first, and what happens after is very much up there. And I very much agree. I mean, who knows who you'll meet in the next 5 years? And at some point, you know, a partner and or, you know, opportunities like the Olympics, that's just fun.
Yeah, and I also think there's no point trying to plan everything down. Because, you know, before I used to be a planner, it's like, okay, this is where I want to be, this is what I want to do, and it doesn't happen. So there's no point trying to, you know, control everything. And
no. Well, and especially, I mean, not to stereotype too much, but I would imagine that, let's say, daily life in Canada is quite different from daily life in Cairo.
Yeah.
How did you, it's a whole different avenue, but how did you adjust to the lifestyle difference? Because I can imagine, you know, tall, blonde, white girl in Egypt is not something, you know, too common. But how do you deal with that transition?
Well, I think right now, like where I live, there's actually quite a few foreigners. So you do feel a bit more, you don't feel like out of place. You don't feel as stared at. Like if you go to an area where it's uncommon to see, then yeah, I might be looked at a bit, but it hasn't ever been in a malicious way or anything like that. So I don't feel uncomfortable, as long as you like dress appropriately. You know, in the squash community, has been, you know, very welcoming. You know, you go to any clubs and everyone has a great sense of humor. Everyone's asked if you need anything, they make sure you're good. But I'd say the main reason I've been able to adjust is, you know, my coach Kareem, he's made sure I can, you know, he's helped me every step of the way to adjust. If I need anything, I can always ask him.
That's nice.
Yeah, it helps. I think having, you know, wherever I've based myself, I always try to have a team.
Yeah, surround yourself with the right people.
Yeah, surround yourself with the right people who you trust. And by having that, like, I feel like I have a community. I've been able to meet some people, which has made it easier. There's been some downs for sure. Like, you miss home, it's very different.
You get homesick?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's part of it. And I think the one benefit is knowing that one, I can't go home right now, so it's outside my control. And then also, you know, everything's shut down at home. So if I go back, it's not like I'm missing out on a ton of things. I think that'll change once, you know, summer comes and things get back to normal. But it's been a bit of an easier to think about, okay, what would I be doing if I were actually home? I'd be able to see my friends, family. It'd be very nice. But here I can play squash. I can keep working towards something. And, you know, it puts it in perspective. So
that makes sense. And I mean, it's also the, you know, your focus bubble that you're in right now. I mean, you're focusing on making that top 10. So that requires, you know, I wouldn't say laser focus maybe, but at least this is what you do.
Because
there's a reason you're a professional player.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Is that maybe interesting? Is it the difference as well between a top 20 player and a top 5 player, that their team around them and the focus on, you know, we're only here to do squash, go through the sessions, get better every day? Is that a difference as well?
Yeah, I'd say so. Like, you know, everyone, you know what you need to do, and you're all in. So I think limiting the distractions definitely would, you know, help them out. But then each person's different. You know, some people, they do better when they have more of a balanced lifestyle. And they can go maybe grab a drink with a friend or do something like that. And then other people who can just be all in. So I think each person has their own balance. For me, it's helped being kind of all in and focused, but I do reach those moments where I'm like, okay, I need to relax, because you don't want to put too much pressure on it by being like, I've done everything. And
how much of so let's say normal Egyptian life do you get to live? Because obviously your focus is the sport, and you know, in one of your videos you mentioned it takes you an hour and a half to get to the facilities to begin with.
Yeah,
so how much time is left for a life?
I mean, normally like Thursday I'll try, and Friday I'll try and go out and grab a bite somewhere, you know, see people. I have a friend who I normally try and grab coffee with on Fridays, and I'll see her, and she knows a lot of like new restaurants. So I, you know, I do try and get out a couple times a week to get some balance, but I don't know, it takes time. Everyone's busy. Everyone lives so far away. So it is hard to catch up with people, I'd say, unless they live within kind of your area.
Yeah. But, okay. So you're not a complete hermit.
Not a complete hermit, but it's taken some time. For a while it was.
Fair enough. Do you, if you look at the difference between the men's game and the women's game, mm-hmm. I think personally looking like the women's game has improved so much in a very short time. Like it's gotten much more aggressive, much faster. Players have gotten much stronger. The differences are also not as big anymore as they used to be, especially with the top players. How do you level those two? Do you think it's more exciting to watch one over the other, or are they at par now?
Yeah, I love watching both. I love watching the women's game, and like I watch it differently when I'm watching the women's game. I'm looking for things like what's each person doing, strategy.
Yeah, because you might play them later.
Yeah, I might play them. And I do find, you know, there's a large variety of styles in the women's game. So it is really entertaining to watch. And then, you know, the men's, I love watching too. Like the pace is crazy. I think you get into a little bit more physicality in the men's with maybe more calls, I would say, which, you know, sometimes can make for an exciting game. Sometimes it can't.
Yeah.
It depends on the match.
Yeah, the margins are very small in the men's games, huh?
Sorry?
The margins are very small in the men's games, I always notice. Like you say, like yeah. There's a lot of calls that can go either way that can often determine the cause of a match.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to have that in the women's, but I feel like we have that a little bit less than the men's. But, you know, both very entertaining. And you get to know everyone. Like, you know, men's players on the men's tour, you know, players on the women's tour. And you obviously want to see people do well. And, you're always going to be cheering for someone, so
yeah, that's true.
I know. You get invested in each
other. You mentioned earlier that you generally see the same group of people, right, at the tournaments. How's the atmosphere amongst each other? Are you guys friendly with each other, or is it, you know, there's a few people that are sort of in their own zone and that's it, or how does that work?
You know, I'd say everyone's very friendly to each other. I personally like to have some space at tournaments, but I mean, I'm still going to. If I see my friends at breakfast, I'm going to talk to them at breakfast. I'm not going to completely shun them or anything like that.
No. Are there players to do that?
No, I wouldn't say so. Maybe if you're about to go to your match, like if it's 3 hours before your match, you might not be talking to people, but you'll still come up and say hi. You won't. So it depends. Like, I mean, breakfast might be a little bit different than like lunch before a match.
Yeah.
And right now it's in the bubble. Like, so you don't see players as much because everyone's, you know, you're in your room.
Yeah, that's it.
Most of the time. So I think it varies. Some people thrive on having the social interaction. They want to be around people, you know, have their friends and have the distraction. And then other people, you know, like having their space and time. So I'd say I'm more like having my space because energy-wise, it's, you know, I am very social and I like talking to people, but it does take energy.
So, yeah, it does take your focus off the prize, so to speak.
Yeah. Fair enough. And you can't control what people will say, what they'll be doing. So you don't want those thoughts to come into your own mindset. So on game days, I'll be a little bit more reserved, I'd say.
Fair enough. But it's, I mean, it's so people are friendly, but it's not like you all go out for dinner after a tournament or something.
Oh, you might, yeah. 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 I think right now it's just weird because we're in the bubble, but, you know, you do still grab dinner with friends and, or you might coordinate time to go and sit and even if it's social distance, grab food at the same time. And it's very friendly.
Is it, because I mentioned earlier that I think the game professionalized a lot over the years, you know, from TV to social and prize money, everything else. As the game becomes more professional, does it move away from that friendliness or it doesn't matter?
I mean, I'd say, you mean as you get closer to the top? Sorry?
The stakes get higher, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say, you know, the closer you get to the top, it's a little bit more reserved.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense, you know.
Well, yeah, if there's, you know, actual serious money on the line and points and whatever it might be, fame.
Yeah, well, and also just, you know, keeping your focus and not wanting to give anything away. And I think I've gone to be, I guess, more focused and reserved as I've gone higher up the rankings. Before, I wouldn't care. I would go out, do, like, see friends, grab meals, hang out at the courts, watch matches, you know, talk with friends before, after losses, and it's changed.
Yeah. You started a YouTube channel. That's how I found you, actually.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. What's your goal with the YouTube channel? What do you want to do with it?
So originally my trainer back in Calgary, Richard, I was talking to him about how I was, you know, struggling to find a bit of balance here. Like, well, why don't you start a YouTube channel, and then you can document what's going on, you can feel connected to people back home, and we can see what you're doing. So that was kind of the original intention behind it.
Therapy.
And inspiration. Yeah. But then also I thought I didn't want to have the channel be all about me, what I'm doing. I think that gets a bit old and repetitive, and there's only so much I can say about my life when the week is pretty much the same.
Same every week, yeah.
Yeah, it's very routine. And so, I mean, I want to give people an idea of what it's like to be here, but also get to know other players, get a sense of, you know, maybe what people do here differently than, you know, training back home. I'd say culturally with the squash community and how people train is very different, at least to Canada. So I think it's, you know, I was hoping to do my next episode actually on maybe just general expenses of training here. If you want to come train, what are some, not giving out specific numbers, but saying what are some costs,
yeah,
what might you want, what, yeah, like how can you make it work? Because like there's a few players who come on tour and it's like maybe they want to base themselves either here or England or France or wherever, and you have no idea what options you have.
Well, yeah,
and
what, so
yeah, so I'm hoping to do an episode one on about training here, coming here, but maybe get more players involved, see what it's like elsewhere, and you know, just get a better sense of the whole squash community, and
yeah,
just see where it goes.
Do you think there's enough so if you look at whatever, football, tennis, big sports, do you think, yeah, there's enough sort of social interaction, if you want to call it that way, that there's enough people, like kids or whatever, finding squash players on YouTube?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, there's only a couple players who are doing,
yeah,
vlogs, but then I guess on online PSA has all the videos of matches and stuff, but, and there are interviews. But you look at tennis, and I mean, you look at what happened with Osaka, but they have all these interviews before and after. You have access to players a lot, yeah, more during the event. And I think PSA has been working on that, so you get more interaction with the players and how they're thinking at events, less so than tennis, less so than, you know, other sports.
Yeah, but squash is a sport still, right?
Sorry?
Squash is still a small sport in the end.
Yeah, it's still growing. So obviously the money and coverage is going to be different to some of the major sports.
Mm.
But I think it's something that the other sports do a very good job of, is giving access to these players. You get a sense of their personalities a lot more. And then if you look at a big sport, let's say like hockey, they have so many community events that they get players involved in, so they're giving back, and they're,
yeah,
it's obviously a very different sort of idea because it's a team sport and you have a community around that one team.
Yeah.
But they'll have fundraisers, they have meet and greets, they have signings after games where you have to sign a jersey and you can talk to these people one-on-one.
Yeah.
And so people get more invested into the sport. So I think having opportunities even like that, let's say you have TOC, and there's obviously going to be sponsors banquets where sponsors get to meet the players, but even having chances, like having a booth and say, okay, this player is going to be here at this time, if you want to meet them and have them sign some shirts so you get a chance to meet them. And you can rotate it based on day or players. And
how does that work for you? Because you have a record sponsor and a shoe sponsor, and I'm sure mm-hmm. other sponsors. How do you, how is your commitment to them? Like, do you actually have to do stuff like that? Show up at booths or at events, or do you have to do corporate speeches, or how does that work?
I mean, it all depends on the contract. I've had some before where I have to show up for an exhibition, like once a year at a club. Right now, I don't actually think I have a commitment like that, but obviously all my social media promoting, and yeah, it's more, I'd say right now, most of my commitments are through social media, and then obviously what I wear during a tournament, I have to obviously wear and show their stuff, yeah. Which makes, you know, makes sense.
Which is fair.
Which is fair. Yeah. So, I mean, it depends on the sponsor, but it's hard to say, okay, I'm giving you this pair of shoes. I need you to fly here and do like interviews and all this sort of stuff. Or
well, I mean, that depends on the dollars attached to it, of course.
Yeah, but if it's in the contract, then yeah, it's part of it. Yeah. And obviously, if I'm doing an interview with PSA, I'd be wearing, you know, my shirts with the logos and showing it. Those are kind of the only real commitments I have through my sponsors.
Is that a fact of life for somebody almost in the top 20 versus somebody who might be in the top 5? That obviously your sponsor commitments will get bigger, the amounts will probably get bigger as well, but that you spend more time on those commitments because that is your income, obviously, than you would be now.
Yeah, I'd say it, you know, it probably makes a difference depending on your level. I don't know yet, obviously, but hopefully one day I can.
Is there I can imagine, obviously, the, you know, money from a sponsor is great, free stuff is great, when you, you know, don't have to think about your shoes, that's a, you know, simple, nice thing. Is there sponsors that you would like to work with in the future, or like in a specific direction or a specific industry or something, or you don't really care?
I know, I'm always open to, you know, any sponsor. Obviously, there's a couple, you know, I don't know why I've always really wanted to be sponsored by Red Bull. I just love the videos. I love like the extreme sports sort of stuff. And obviously a few squash players are sponsored by Red Bull. I think it's a bit outside the realm right now. I was looking at Canadian sponsored by Red Bull, and it was like all world champions in like downhill skiing and snowboarding and all those pretty cool sports.
A bit more extreme.
A bit more extreme than squash. yeah.
But I can imagine that obviously when, you know, a company that makes missiles wants to sponsor you, you're like, maybe not. But if a company that whatever makes organic yoga mats, I don't know, then it is much more interesting. I mean, crazy example, but there's no specific sponsors that you would seek out, like, oh, I want, you know, people from an ethical industry or people from bio industry or something.
No, I mean, I would care about ethics behind it. You don't want someone working with like children who are, you know, working at like 6 years old or something like that.
Yeah, some questionable circumstances.
I do care about supporting companies in Alberta and in Canada. Like I do care, like I would love to support local companies. And that's important to me. And I'd say most of the companies, at least that I've met and talked to in, you know, Calgary and Canada, they are on the ethical sort of line, and do care about inclusivity and you know, development and everything like that. So I do care about those things.
You got the nice ones.
Yeah, I like to support Canadian companies as well.
Is there do companies come to you, or do you actively approach companies? Do you have a manager, for example, that does that for you?
I don't have a manager. I do get some help from Jamie Nichols, who works with Squash Canada sometimes. I'll ask him, like, hey, can you reach out to this company, because he might have a contact, and he's done fundraising a lot for both Squash Ontario and Squash Canada, so I've asked him for help. But it's not like an official thing. And then otherwise, I put together a player package that I made, kind of promoting myself, saying what I do, my social media, everything like that. So if there's a company that I want to approach, I'll send that to them and I'll tailor it to that company.
Okay.
And then I've been very fortunate. I've had some other companies and other people just, you know, message me and say, hey, we'd love to support you. What do you think?
How can we make it work?
So it goes both ways. So it goes both ways. I seek out some people come to me and.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Nice. But the back of your shirt, there's still room for prints for more logos and names.
Yes, definitely.
That's nice. Obviously you can live off your sport. I would imagine you're not driving a Bentley quite yet. Is it is that the goal, or is it just you want to have, you know, a good professional fun career and it makes a bit of money, which is nice, but it's not going to get you that Bentley? Or what's the balance there?
I mean, for me, squash has never been about the money. If I cared about the money, I probably would have gone and played tennis.
It probably a different sport, yeah, you're right.
Sport, but yeah, I would have picked a different sport. I mean, I get a lot of support from like government funding and stuff. Like that's why I'm able to play. I wouldn't say I'm at a point where I'm, you know, making some big bucks or anything like that, but I'm surviving and I'm doing well. But you know, my whole thing with playing squash is my goal and my dream for the sport. I don't care about the money as much. Like as long as I can get by, I'm good. And you know, once I retire, then you know, then my focus might change a little bit. And
see about that, yeah.
I think it'll change a bit, but you know, I'm here just to play.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Those were all my questions, actually. Is there some stories you want to tell?
No, I think covered quite a lot.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
Cool. Then that's what we'll end the podcast on. Thank you very much for all your answers and your openness on the live.
No, thanks for having me.
And I hope we can do this again when you actually reach that top 10.
Yes, hopefully. That'd be great.
That was it for this episode of the Long Jump Podcast. Great thanks to Danielle for taking the time all the way from Cairo to talk to me. Being so open about her life. I think it's a very, very interesting insight into how a professional athlete actually approaches her work, her sport, her passion, and I really enjoyed this talk. I put all the links to Danielle's social platforms in the show notes, of course. You heard us talk about her YouTube channel a few times. Definitely worth following her journey there, but also Instagram and all the other platforms I'll put in. This was it for this episode. Hope you enjoyed the listen as much as I did the talk, and I'll definitely catch you guys in the next one. Cheers!